Game on. Tennis.
With the majority of sports getting their house in order for a return to play, it's unusual to see one of the most socially distant and exciting sports like tennis not up and running. Stephen Higgins from the brilliant CrossCourtView.com joins us now to bring us up to speed with all the action, but more importantly, all the off-court drama with Twitter rants, world number ones behaving badly, and a 16-year-old ray of hope that is a credit with and without her racket. Stephen, how's it going?
I suppose as good as you can be for a sport that's shut down for 4 months at this stage.
Yeah, it's not like you're counting the days. 121 days you put down your notes earlier on. You must be starved of action of tennis, Stephen.
Well, you're certainly not starved of drama. I think all the players twiddling their thumbs on social media, they've revealed all sides of their personality, both positive and negative, in the months since.
Yeah, and we'll go into them all, but can we start with Coco Gauff? Because I think she deserves the most credit out of all of them. They've all been behaving in different ways, but she's been, like we say, a ray of hope.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting combination of her and Naomi Osaka, that there was a lovely moment last year where Osaka beat Gauff at the US Open, and the moment was a bit too much for Gauff in a second set as Osaka kind of blew her away. But she was on the verge of tears, and Osaka brought her into the interview, and they did it together, and it was this nice kind of sign of camaraderie in a sometimes vicious sport. But the Black Lives Matter movement has really obviously shone a light on the inequalities between the races, and Coco Gauff, who's still only 16, and Naomi Osaka have been at the forefront of that, so they're kind of inheriting that bar that, say, someone like Martina Navratilova or Billie Jean King have of being outspoken athletes on social issues, and they're extremely impressive. And there's a great speech, if people want to see, on YouTube or so, of Coco Gauff to a crowd about a month ago talking about the issues and how they affect her and what she wants. And, you know, she's 16 and she's a tennis player who you think would just be solely focused on tennis, and she's been extremely impressive, just her thoughts and all, for someone so young.
But then the flip side of that, potentially the more entertaining and maybe not quite as rational, Nick Kyrgios has been unbelievable value on Twitter. Probably has too much time on his hands to be at home venting his anger about various things.
The world has really turned upside down because Nick Kyrgios is now the most responsible tennis player on the planet. He, I mean, if you remember back to the Australian Open when he led the appeal for the bushfire crisis, and he was at the forefront of that, organising a big charitable tournament. And in the time since, he's been, getting into arguments with Boris Becker. And last night, I mean, this is just brilliant, where people may have heard about this Adria Tour that Novak Djokovic was one of the four runners organising. That turned out to be a disaster in the Adriatic, where they had an exhibition event. Loads of players tested positive, including Djokovic. And Kyrgios has been very critical about that ever since. And last night he was talking again about it, and was it the great criticising the players who were partying like potatoes during a pandemic, which is lovely alliteration, nothing else.
And you mentioned that there are obviously Boris Becker, renowned and much appreciated within tennis. It's unusual for these two to kind of go at it, isn't it?
Well, Boris Becker, in a really strange series of tweets, was calling, says he didn't like rats. So basically calling Kyrgios a rat, like when you were in primary school or so, giving about someone telling on the teacher. But Kyrgios is absolutely right of this is an extremely serious situation, and the players are, you know, at the top of the sport, and they have to set an example. And he's absolutely right to call it out, particularly after the Adria Tour.
But you talk about it there, the criticism of the Adria Tour, that the sport as a whole, if we can draw the comparison with horse racing and the pressure that was put on horse racing in Ireland as a result of Cheltenham, which didn't have anything to do with them, that you now look at when the tour eventually does try to get up and running, there's going to be such a focus on competitive tennis as a result of fairly irresponsible behaviour behind, you know, that event a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, but there are a lot of conflicting and concurrent issues at one time. So say, for instance, if you look at one other side of it, that If the sport has to stop until there's a vaccine, what if there isn't a vaccine? So there's that in mind. But tennis, a bit like golf, I think we were talking earlier, is almost uniquely positioned as one of the worst sports afflicted by something like this because of its international reach, because you have thousands of sole traders who move from one destination to another through all these different travel restrictions. And because the situation is so precarious and changing all the time, how can you plan ahead? So say the tours have organize a new calendar to start back from August, like early August or so. But what confidence would you have that any of the events can be held given what's happening day to day?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it. And just on Damien's point there about, you know, the leaders, Djokovic as a leader, we've seen the likes of Marcus Rashford setting a good standard, but Djokovic here has done a terrible job for the game, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think the thing about the Adria Tour was the almost the brazenness of it, that it's one thing about the restrictions in the stadium. If people saw it, was broadcast on, I think, Eurosport at the time. And in the height of the pandemic, you saw 6,000 or 7,000 fans all packed together in the boiling heat in the stadium.
Players embracing each other.
Yeah, all day. But then added on the off-hour stuff of dancing in nightclubs, topless, playing basketball, hugging, all this kind of thing. And you're just kind of, what planet are these people on? It was all that additional stuff.
But yes, like we opened the programme tonight talking about the Ryder Cup and the difficult decision that's been made to postpone the Ryder Cup until next year. And I don't know that people often look into the insurance that's at play and host broadcasters and people with tickets. And there's 100 million moving parts. And yet we're in a situation here where we still think we are planning for a US Open and a French Open to still go ahead this year. And you'd wonder just how okay, it's great to have ambitions and it's great to have targets, but how realistic are they?
Well, one thing just on the Ryder Cup, I suppose, is I remember going to it when it was here in the K Club. The Ryder Cup is uniquely one of those things where it's all about the fans. Mm. Like the entire thing is about the fans, so it's very hard to run that without them. Tennis actually can run without fans, because if anyone follows the tour route, there are a lot of tournaments around the world at the time where there aren't really any fans. And particularly lower down, you'll have very few people. At the moment, they've rescheduled for a US Open at the end of August and a French Open at the end of September. The US Open will have very strict protocols, no spectators, restrictions on the number of people who can go in terms of entourage and practice, etc. Roland Garros is very ambitiously looking at something like 50 to 60% of a crowd, which I don't see how that will really work. But all these predictions and projections, I just think you have no real confidence in it because things are fluctuating so much. Say even the case in Melbourne where they've embarked on a 6-week lockdown now. Mm. There is consideration that Roland Garros might go ahead, but there might not be another Grand Slam until Roland Garros next year because of the problems just of travel and fear of it.
Yeah, and you mentioned it there, Stephen. It's like sole traders. So like putting the betterment of the whole sport ahead is quite difficult, but it shows the grow for tennis in France when you see that, you know, the soccer got cancelled, the rugby got cancelled. No way they were cancelling the tennis.
I think there is another side to it in that while the Adria Tour has gotten so much attention, there have been successful exhibitions held with the strict protocols, like Jamie Murray's Battle of the Brits tournament and Patrick Mouratoglou's Ultimate Tennis Showdown, where they just had basically no spectators, one umpire, possibly coaches, and a really barren court, and a small group of players in one location. It is doable on those terms, but the problem comes with obviously bigger tournaments with more prize money, ranking points. How can you host Grand Slams in that scenario?
And that is the big issue, isn't it? With regard to, obviously a decision has been made to freeze rankings, but how long do you kick that down the road? And if it comes to a situation where certain players can't enter certain countries to take part in certain events, how do you have an equitable ranking system?
Yeah, I think they've actually done a good job, the ATP, in terms of it's the best way they could do it, of no one really loses their ranking because it's frozen. And if you want to go out and play, you can get some credit for it. But the big issue, as you say, is the sole traders. There are governing bodies. There are thousands of people who are just running their own lives, and it's very hard to corral them into following the behaviour. And I personally would just think that because of the precarious situation, we should kind of just write off the rest of the year, support the tournaments with funding obviously from the main body, but you have to plan for next year of what are we going to do if there isn't a vaccine, as you probably would expect. How are you going to organise some sort of tour? It looks very difficult.
Stephen, I know we're tight on time and you'll never get to explain all the rankings, but what they're looking at doing now is putting it into a 22-month calendar, is that right?
Yeah, so it's your best 18 tournaments over the course of 22 months. They only count your best of the same. So say Rafa Nadal won Roland Garros in the US Open last year, he wouldn't get any credit, sadly, if he won them both again this year, which means that they are releasing them from the responsibility that if he doesn't want to play the tournaments, he isn't hindered by that. But if you you didn't do so well at the end of last year, you can improve your rankings.
It's like when you repeat the leave and then you swap one for the other. But certainly that's how it was back in my day. Just to finish, one thing that perhaps got lost in a lot of the coverage was, like, Roger Federer, who is as big a weight in terms of discussion and topics as you will find, talking very openly about the prospect of uniting the two tours and having one single entity. Is it going to be the start of a solid conversation about that now, do you think?
Well, it was in the weeks after he said it. Now, in fairness, Billie Jean King was advocating for this decades ago. So he's kind of joined the conversation along with Andy Murray. It makes a lot of sense given the bargaining power that they would have and the issues of organising fully equal prize money across the tournaments. Particularly in the years ahead where it'll be very difficult to navigate this stretch, that it obviously just makes a lot of sense for two of them to be united. And bear in mind, there isn't a players' union at the moment, which again, doesn't make a lot of sense.
Stephen Higgins from crosscourtview.com, thanks so much.
Game on 2FM.